Our first case this morning, United States against Smead. Counsel for the defense, you may proceed.
May it please the court, I am Captain Bob Wicaza, and I represent the appellant in this case, Staff Sergeant Andrew Smead. Chief Judge Efron, with your permission, I'd like to reserve 3 minutes of my time for rebuttal.
Maybe you may have that.
The appellant in this case, Staff Sergeant Smead, in 2001, entered into a pretrial agreement with the United States government, whereby he would plead guilty to certain offenses, specifically indecent acts and possession and receipt of child pornography. In exchange, he would receive certain specific bargain for benefits from the United States government. Among those was a guarantee for sex offender treatment at the brig at Miramar, as well as the dismissal of the charges to which he pled not guilty to with prejudice, and, of course, a confinement cap. I received a confinement cap of 12 years on a sentence of 24 years. After this first court-martial, the government failed to satisfy its obligations under the pretrial agreement by failing to ensure that the appellant could be enrolled in the sexual offender treatment program at Miramar. Accordingly, this issue was raised on appeal, and the lower court found that this was a breach of the pretrial agreement and directed the government to either fashion a sufficient alternative remedy, provide specific performance, or provide some other relief to the appellant. The government elected to do none of those three options, in which case the lower court set aside the findings and sentence and sent the case back for rehearing. At rehearing, the government reinstituted all the charges which had previously been referred against the appellant to include, most importantly...
Counsel, I think you left out one of the CCA opinions, didn't you? Wasn't there an interim opinion of the Court of Criminal Appeals?
Correct, Your Honor. There was the initial opinion which gave the government three options. After the government failed to take any of those three options, there was a per curiam opinion in which the lower court set aside the findings and sentence.
What happened at that point?
The case was returned for rehearing, Your Honor. At the rehearing, the previously dismissed charges were brought forward. The appellant, through counsel, raised an objection specifically to the rape charge, as it had been dismissed with prejudice by the first pretrial agreement. The military judge ruled that the parties are placed in status quo ante and the government could go forward on the rape charge. The lower court affirmed. The question granted by this court here today is whether the government's decision to reinstitute the charge which had previously been dismissed with prejudice served to the material prejudice of the appellant. Assessing the record and the case, it's plain that the appellant did suffer prejudice from the government's decision to reinstitute the rape charge. First and foremost, as the government concedes in its answer brief, Article 63 would not have prevented the appellant from facing the maximum punishment of the rape charge, which was life without parole. As the rape charge was not considered during the first court-martial, there was no protection of Article 63. Therefore, appellant was faced with, again...
You're doing various what-if things there. What's the evidence on the record as to the actual prejudice? It's the declaration, right?
That's correct, Your Honor. The declaration of the appellant indicates that the rape charge was the foremost reason for him to enter into the pretrial agreement, which he did.
He says, I do not believe that I would have entered into this pretrial agreement, which sounds like a present tense belief at the time. Maybe it was his belief then, maybe not. Why did he tell the judge that he was doing all of this voluntarily and knowingly if he was being coerced into it?
Yes, Your Honor. His statement to the judge that he was doing this voluntarily and knowingly had to do with some traditional duress or some type of threat or life threat or physical force being placed against him. The threat in this case, or the coercion in this case, was from a legal sense and the legal posture he'd been placed in procedurally, which had already been litigated before the military judge. So his statements during the providency of the second court martial shouldn't be interpreted to inform upon this specific issue.
Counsel, returning to the second proceedings before the Court of Criminal Appeals, what relief did the defense ask for at that time? The government had failed to perform any of its obligations. What did the defense ask the court to do?
I believe it was to set aside the findings, Your Honor.
So the defense did not ask for specific performance at that time?
Oh, I'm sorry, Your Honor. Yes, the defense asked for specific performance. There was some efforts made administratively. There's some evidence in the record where I believe a memo was sent to the USDB from the government to try to get the appellant transferred. One element of the government indicated that, yes, he should be transferred. However, no action was taken as a result of that. So, yes, the initial the initial steps that were taken were to try to get specific performance.
But was that at the CCA the second time, or was that before it came to the CCA the second time? In other words, what specifically and where in the record does it show what the defense asked for the second time the case came to the CCA?
Simply in the brief filed before the lower court, Your Honor, would be the only place where there would be any.
Right. And what did the defense ask for there? Did they ask for a specific performance, or did they ask for the case to be, for the findings and sentence to be set aside?
At the second time, a specific performance was no longer an option, as the appellant had completed his confinement, Your Honor. So at that point, the only thing available was to ask for the setting aside of the findings and sentence. The appellant received substantial good time credit at his rehearing.
So by the time I'm not talking about the rehearing. I'm talking about the proceedings before the Court of Criminal Appeals in 2005. Had he been released from confinement at that time?
So you're talking about the first MCCA opinion, Your Honor?
No. The opinion that's in the joint appendix on page 5. Now, this is a tough one. It's tough to keep apart all three of the opinions of the Court of Criminal Appeals and what was asked for at each time, but we've got one. Page 5 of the joint appendix decided June 22, 2005. At that point, he had not received any of the performance on the sentencing at Miramar that he'd requested. So what did he ask the CCA to do when the case came before the CCA again?
I do not see that on that. I don't think that's clear from the record, Your Honor.
It's not clear from the record. Here, is the brief in the record? Does it tell us?
I could be mistaken, Your Honor. I do not believe another brief was filed that the court took its own action. I could be incorrect.
And did the accused, the appellant, say at that point, no, that's not what I want? I don't want this case to go back to the convening authority who may order a rehearing. I want my specific performance, or I want some alternative relief.
I'm not aware of anything specific on the record from the appellant that says that beyond the one declaration that we do have, Your Honor.
So when the case goes back to the convening authority at that time, why can't the convening authority order a rehearing?
The objection isn't with the rehearing, Your Honor. The objection is with the reinstitution of the charges which have been dismissed with prejudice.
Well, the findings of guilty and the sentence are set aside on June 22nd. There's no order for specific performance at that point, is there?
Not on the record, Your Honor.
So what did the convening authority do wrong?
They're re-referring the charges which have been dismissed with prejudice.
I understand that that's what you're arguing now, but I'm asking in the context of the Court of Criminal Appeals opinion on June 22nd, 2005, what did the convening authority do wrong at that point? Or did the Court of Criminal Appeals err at that point? Where are we after that June 22nd, 2005 order?
Yeah, my understanding of the record, Your Honor, is the government did not communicate it had taken any action at all. It took some preliminary steps for specific performance, and it didn't do anything beyond that. As a result of that, it was a per curiam opinion.
Well, I mean, you keep on talking about the government not doing anything in terms of specific performance, but wasn't the problem with the pretrial agreement in the first place that what they had promised to do and thought they could promise to do was something that, in fact, they could not do?
Ultimately, that is correct, Your Honor.
In terms of specific performance, the convening authority could want to have this person transferred to Miramar all day long, but they couldn't do it, right? And the CCA doesn't have any authority to tell the disciplinary barracks what to do in terms of transfer this person back to Miramar, do they?
That is correct, Your Honor. And obviously, neither do the convening authority. They made some efforts, but at least in the record, they appeared to be partial efforts. Now, ultimately,
well, counsel, what does it say in the record? Is there any judicial finding in the record that this specific performance could not be given? Did the military judge find that this specific performance could not be given?
At the rehearing, the military judge's findings were simply that specific performance was not given. I don't believe
that it was
that.
Not given.
Did
the military judge find that as a matter of law that it could not be given?
That is correct, Your Honor. He made some statements on the record that the convening authority did not have the authority to force the penal system to transfer the appellant to a specific.
And did the military judge find that the penal system could not do that? Could not give him a sentence at Miramar? Is there a finding of law that that sentence could not be administered in the manner contemplated by the pretrial agreement?
I believe the military judge's findings were that the Navy and Marine Corps did not have the ability to force that transfer to happen. I think, obviously, the transfer could have happened physically speaking, but they didn't have the authority to make
it. I understand that. This is the United States government. Is there a finding that the United States government could not implement the agreement that it made?
I do not believe so, Your Honor.
And in the third CCA opinion, doesn't this Court of Criminal Appeals say inexplicably, no one can tell us what happened?
Yes, Your Honor.
What do we do about the 2004 opinion at the CCA on page 3 where it says, but the appellant acknowledges that he was transferred pursuant to regulations that overrode the CA's authority to direct the place of confinement. Apparently, all parties to the trial misunderstood or were not aware of those regulations. I mean, wasn't that the basis for saying that it was a breach of the pretrial agreement, but not one where the government was at fault?
Well, the fault would be negligence, Your Honor. I think the appellant would agree that there wasn't any explicit bad faith where the government took specific efforts to frustrate pretrial agreement. However, the government represented itself to be able to bargain for something it could not perform, so that would be a negligence part. And the appellant would argue that would still be government's conduct, albeit simply negligence.
Isn't this like the old Ship Perilous case where they never meet because you never have a meeting of the minds? You know, you're promising something you can't deliver. So the whole thing evaporates, and you go back to square one as a matter of contract theory.
Apparently, the reason 90% of that, Your Honor, the key difference in this case being that the United States, I think it's entirely reasonable for the appellant to believe that the United States government can direct where he's going to be confined, and between the two parties.
Well, I mean, in many contracts, one party believes entirely reasonable that the other party can deliver. But in fact, if he's powerless to do so, then they're operating under misapprehension. There's never any meeting of the minds.
And between the two parties, Your Honor, the United States government is in a much better position to understand what it can or cannot perform and represent itself as being able to perform.
Okay. Well, maybe you can help me out, because my understanding was that when the appellant first went to the CCA back in 2004, what his claim was is, you know, my pleas were improvident because I didn't get the benefit of my pretrial agreement, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
And at that point in time, what ordinarily happens when someone says, my pleas were improvident, doesn't it go back for a rehearing or some other reasonable decision by the CCA?
That is generally correct, Your Honor. However, I think...
And all of this is sort of irrelevant to your argument today, isn't it, which is the issue that we're supposed to be talking about, I thought, which is whether or not, in this case, the government was allowed to retry him on the charge that had previously been withdrawn.
Yes, Your Honor.
So why don't you talk about how he was prejudiced in with respect to that issue?
Yes, Your Honor. He was prejudiced in two aspects. The first aspect being he faced the maximum punishment for the rape charge, so he did not have the protection of Article 63. So he was faced with the possibility of life without the possibility of parole. Secondly, at the second court-martial, the government was in possession of inculpatory statements he had made, which it did not have at the first court-martial. So he is in a tactically degraded position. So between the maximum punishment he faced and his tactical position, which had been degraded, had served to prejudice the appellant, as evidenced by his declaration, in which he indicated that the rape charge was a... But for the rape charge, he did not believe he would have entered into that specific pretrial agreement.
Wasn't it dismissed with prejudice the second time?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. Didn't he get a better deal the second time?
He did, Your Honor.
Where's the prejudice?
I think it would be speculative to say that because he got a better deal, there was no prejudice. The only way to verify that there was...
I think that's an interesting proposition, but go ahead.
Yes, sir. That presumes that the rape charge, that but for the rape charge, he would have been able to negotiate the same agreement. Appellant would submit that because that...
He got a better agreement.
Yes, sir, and that presumes that he would not have got the better agreement regardless of the rape charge, that simply because of the time that had elapsed and the witnesses being aged...
Well, I'm not interested in the theory of whether he could have gotten a better agreement. He got a better agreement. Are you saying, as you, I think you said in either your brief or your reply brief, that he could have gotten a yet better agreement?
Yes, Your Honor.
And null set theory or whatever you called it?
The null hypothesis.
Well, can you cite me a case where that's been used to adjudicate prejudice?
Well, Your Honor, the case I would point to would be United States versus Wheelis. Specifically, ultimately, a pretrial agreement is a contractual burden on the convening authority to provide a specific form of clemency. So the body of case law which this court should look to in assessing prejudice or any error in the administering of that should be its body of case law on clemency. And United States versus Wheelis talks about clemency being a highly discretionary executive function. So if an appellant can make some colorable showing of prejudice, that would be sufficient. Again, so given it's very difficult to speculate how would the negotiations have occurred if the appellant did not need to bargain away this rape charge, which shouldn't have been there in the first place. Because it's difficult on appeal to go back to that circumstance, for one, appellant argues that both parties should simply be returned to the bargaining table with a proper balance of power. And second, the standard should simply be if there's a culpable showing. Otherwise, it would require too much speculation of what the convening authority may have.
Well, to me, the null hypothesis is totally speculation. I mean, what have you got there? You're saying, well, maybe he could have gotten an even better deal. That's pure speculation. The fact is, he got a better deal the second. He got it dismissed with prejudice, and he got a better deal the second time around.
I feel I understand, Your Honor, and if I may offer an analogy, if I will.
Please do.
If there had been some error, if this is a post-trial case, and there had been some error in the submission of clemency matters, but the appellant received clemency anyways, simply the mere fact that the appellant had already received clemency and some reduction in a sentence would not by itself indicate there is no prejudice from the error in the post-trial processing or the error in the submission of his clemency matters. It's sufficient in that case to show that there was some error in the submission of the post-trial clemency matters and that there's some colorable showing of prejudice. So even if the inquiry knocked a year or two off of his sentence, that wouldn't be sufficient to say, hey, you already got clemency because you already knocked a year or two off. That's why the standard should simply be if there's a colorable showing, return the parties back to where they should be and let the process work the way it should. And at that point, would we be able to know if there was or was not any prejudice from the error?
Counsel, other than the possibility of a prosecution for perjury, if your client had made statements at a second court-martial that were in complete variance with statements at the first court-martial, what are you relying on for the proposition that the government could somehow use statements made at his first court-martial against him? Because, I mean, it sounds to me like you're saying they were in a tactically superior position, but my understanding is, and maybe this is wrong, you can tell me that they couldn't use what he had said at his first court-martial as affirmative evidence against him.
Yes, Your Honor, I see if I'm out of time for me to answer the question.
You may answer Judge Ryan's question.
Thank you, Your Honor. Two different aspects, Your Honor. First of all, just simply looking at the perjury false statement prosecution, if the appellant were to take the stand
and lie, then that would be bad.
Okay. Or not but even lie.
I'm not interested. I already said, leaving that aside, what's the second way?
Yes, sir. Appellant's interpretation of legislative history is that the limitation on the use of the prior statements at a plea agreement which had been withdrawn is to impeach later credibility, but if there are statements that are in direct contradiction, legislative history contemplates that.
I'm not interested in the legislative history. Do you have a case or a rule or a statute that says that the government could use that?
Other than the legislative history and the argument that the appellant put forth in his reply brief for Military Rule of Evidence 410, that would be limited to that. However, during, say, at the second court-martial, the appellant had taken the stand, even putting aside the perjury false statement prosecution, which would be a separate proceeding, government counsel would have an advantage in being able to cross-examine the appellant. Let's assume the appellant didn't want to lie and simply wanted to tell the truth. Well, now the government counsel would know the limits of where the appellant could go, and in the process of cross-examining him, could cross-examine him and direct him through the, without even necessarily explicitly using those statements, having them, and the appellant knowing he can't contradict them and can't lie. Government counsel could guide the appellant through those to get the inculpatory information that he wanted.
Did appellant's statement, would you agree that appellant's statement to NCIS, just taking his statement to NCIS, that that alone would support a conviction for the child pornography, the touching of the daughter, et cetera, irrespective of any other evidence?
Yes, Your Honor. But although the court did not grant the appellant's motion to attach that statement to the record, however, yes, appellant would agree with that.
Thank you, counsel. You have an opportunity on rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Counsel for the government.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Lieutenant Commander Paul Bungie, and I, together with Colonel Luculio, represent the United States in this case. On the issue of whether the appellant suffered prejudice for purposes of Article 59A, the government's answer is no. And there are two parts to the government's answer. First is just a purely factual analysis of what's happened in this case, in this record, and also a legal point, which is, if there is no error, then we should not even reach the prejudice analysis under Article 59A. First, as to the factual analysis, looking first at MRE 410, which is the thrust of appellant's argument in his brief to this court, is that the statements he made in the first trial could have been used against him. Military Rule of Evidence 410, A2, prohibits the use of any statement made in any judicial proceeding. It's a flat-out absolute bar, so that evidence could not have been used. If this truly was an issue that appellant was concerned about at the first trial, he should have made a motion to make that clear before the military judge, and I'm sure that the military judge would have ruled in accordance with the law, stating that those statements could not have been used for any purpose whatsoever. In addition, any evidence derived as fruit of those prior statements, I'm sure, would be inadmissible as well under the plain language of MRE 410. So the mere fact that those statements were made at the providency inquiry don't prejudice appellant because the rule provides, as a matter of law, that they cannot be used against him. And that's precisely so that in the event of a rehearing after guilty pleas are set aside, the appellant is not prejudiced by any earlier actions.
That's a fair, not infrequent occurrence, right? Where cases where someone pleaded guilty, it's set aside as improvident for one reason or another.
Absolutely, Your Honor. That happens quite commonly. And it would surely tilt the playing field if the government could then, if an appellant decided to plead not guilty at a subsequent trial, if the government could use all those previous statements, that would hardly make it very worthwhile since there's now a record where the appellant has admitted his guilt, which is why that's inadmissible. There's an obvious policy reason for that. Number two, the...
Counsel, three seems to relate to a plea of nolo and a plea of guilty, which was later withdrawn. Are you analogizing this to a plea that's withdrawn?
No, I'm just looking at RCM 410A2, which prohibits introduction of any statement made in the course of any judicial inquiry regarding any either guilty plea or nolo plea.
Well, regarding either of the foregoing pleas, there's not a nolo plea here. Was there a plea of guilty that was withdrawn?
There was a plea of guilty
That was busted. Is that the same? That's what I'm asking you. Are you analogizing this to a withdrawn guilty plea?
Yes, I believe that rule would apply as well in this situation.
Okay, let's go cosmic. What happens or what should happen in contractual theory when a PTA is busted on appeal?
When a PTA is broken, regardless of which party breaches, in the absence of any bad faith or other evidence of malice or bad acting on either party, then the parties are merely returned to status quo ante, and this court has stated that repeatedly.
Counsel, haven't we stated that the first thing that has to happen is that there has to be specific performance, that the mere non-compliance or non-performance does not bust the plea by itself? What do Perrone and those other cases stand for?
Well, those cases were the cases of the failure to pay the waived and deferred forfeitures.
Yeah. There's non-performance,
and there was non-performance by the government.
Does that bust the plea right away, or first must there be a proceeding with an effort towards specific performance, alternative relief, et cetera?
Yes, absolutely. There's a process that the parties can go through. The government can offer specific performance, and that can cure any defect. The parties can enter into a subsequent agreement under the supervision of the Court of Criminal
Appeals. So I interrupted your response to Judge Stuckey, but I just want to clarify that the non-performance by itself does not invalidate the plea, the agreement, or extend the parties back to status quo ante, does it?
Not necessarily, no. The case law is also very clear. I just kind of skipped over the interim part there, but there are ways of curing and cure. In this case, I agree with appellate counsel that there were efforts by the government, both the Navy personnel command and Marine Corps personnel folks communicated with the disciplinary barracks in an attempt to get the accused transferred back to Miramar. Those efforts ultimately proved fruitless.
Okay, the government screwed this up.
Yes, the committee
the government screwed this up.
Promised something that they...
They promised something they couldn't, and, you know, treating government as a unitary entity. The government screwed this up. The government said, we will let you have this.
Yes.
And then they didn't deliver. Because, in fact, the government couldn't deliver. Why should the government then be allowed to profit by re-referring these charges?
The government didn't profit. They were just merely put in the same position they were before. And looking at the issue from a contract theory, what you have is both parties at the time of the original pretrial agreement in 2001, both parties thought that was something the government could do, and that turned out to be a mistake on both parties' behalf. So what we have is
a mutual mistake
as far as contract law. And as the military judge found, there was no evidence whatsoever of any bad faith, and the defense counsel at trial admitted. I believe that was either joint appendix at, I believe, page 60, that they had no evidence of any bad faith at all on part of the government. And in the evidence of a mutual mistake, in contract law, the contract is just set aside, and the parties are returned to status quo ante.
Well, is it a mutual mistake, or is it a failure of performance? I mean, you know, if you contract to deliver 500 bushels of wheat on a date certain, and on a date certain, you haven't got 500 bushels of wheat, or you've only got 100 bushels of wheat, then what?
That would be certainly a breach. I'm not sure if that's perfectly analogous here.
The government promised 2 years at Miramar, and when the time to perform came, the government couldn't get him 2 years at Miramar.
True, and in the wheat example, if it was where both parties were relying on the assumption that a particular farmer was going to deliver the 500 bushels of wheat, and there was a severe drought that prevented that wheat from being grown, now you might have a mutual mistake scenario. It all depends on what the underlying facts here. And I think the facts in this case show that it was just a mutual mistake and no evidence of bad faith. And because the government could not specifically perform, that left the parties with a couple options, which is either just set aside the pleas and return to status quo ante, or they could have entered into some sort of post-trial agreement to cure the error. And I was checking to see if I could find anything about what the accused actually asked for. I couldn't find that.
How'd the case get to the Court of Criminal Appeals the second time? That's a mystery in the joint appendix.
That is, and I'm not sure if...
Well, you're the representative of the government. Tell us how it got there.
I would have to go back and check the record again, Your Honor.
Okay.
And I would assume that the court set a certain time limit to the court to, you know, come back to us and give us an answer if you're able to accomplish this or not. And I assume the government came back and said, we're unable to effect a transfer back to Miramar.
You're assuming that, but does the record establish at any place that the United States government could not transfer him to Miramar?
Yeah, I cannot give you a specific site right now to the record, just based on...
I've read the record. I didn't see... It's a long record. I certainly could have missed it. I didn't see anywhere where the United States government said that it couldn't do this. There's correspondence between various elements of the United States government about people not wanting to do it. But did the United States government make a decision that it could not fulfill the promise made by the representative of the government in negotiating a pretrial agreement with this appellant.
Other than the statements made to the CCE below that the government could not do it, whether the United States specifically said we are precluded from doing so as a matter of law, I cannot answer that.
Do you know what the regulations are that the CCA was referring to in its 2004 opinion?
No, I do not. In the 2004, no, I do not. I do not have those specific regulations before.
Okay. Do you have any idea, I mean, if the CCA references regulations that made this outside the CA's purview, and do you know where it's getting that from?
No, I don't. I don't want to give a specific answer. I would just have to speculate that it was the penal regulations that the Department of the Army runs as far as the USDB.
Counsel, in your brief on page 10, page 11, you state that the convening authority does not have the authority to either withdraw or dismiss a charge with prejudice, and that any attempt to do so is a legal nullity. That's the position of the government?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. Well, in this case, the appellant has entered into a pretrial agreement convening authority has agreed to withdraw the rape charge and dismiss it with prejudice. Has the convening authority done that?
And that depends on what the parties mean by with prejudice.
In the record of this case, one of the arguments that there's no prejudice is he got the benefit of the bargain. The rape charge has been withdrawn with prejudice. Has it?
The convening authority actually just says that the charges were withdrawn. In the record of trial, the trial counsel represented to the military judge that the charges were withdrawn, which would, in the trial counsel's words, ripen into with prejudice upon acceptance of the...
This is on the second trial in the rehearing.
This is the second rehearing, yes, Your Honor.
Now, based on the government's position on page 10, that's not permissible, is it? It is not permissible, in the government's view, for the convening authority to make the agreement that he made the second time around.
The government's position is that the with prejudice language is just simply a legal nullity because a convening authority has no authority under the...
As a military judge?
Military judge has authority to dismiss charges with prejudice in a couple contexts. One is a speedy trial context and the other is where the government refuses to disclose or provide discovery on classified or privileged information.
So the military judge at the first court-martial accepting the government's motion to dismiss the charges, that was irrelevant as well in your view?
That's the government's position, and what we're...
So the court is no point in having a judge there at all, is there?
Well,
what is the authority of a court?
If that language in the pretrial agreement does in fact have the effect of a dismissal with prejudice where it can never be revived again, no matter what happens, then the United States would respectfully request this court just make that clear. What we were looking at was Judge Michael's dissenting opinion in Cook. It was the Court of Criminal Appeals opinion in Cook almost 28 years ago, where the same problem occurred, the with without prejudice, and he pointed out that that's something that convening authorities can't do. They just withdraw charges. They don't...
When they get the case on Article 60, can't they dismiss? You're saying that a convening authority who gets a case on Article 60, like this convening authority got in the first trial and it got in the second trial, that convening authority cannot dismiss with prejudice at that point. Not talking about pre-trial, not talking about pre-referral, after case has been referred, tried. Your view is that the convening authority cannot dismiss a charge with prejudice, even at the Article 60 stage.
Yes, because
then in this case, don't we have another problem here? Don't we have an appellant who can be tried for rape tomorrow, even though he made an agreement with the convening authority and the convening authority promised him that if he pled guilty, that wouldn't happen?
In this case, no, because there's still a pretrial agreement in effect.
Did the military judge dismiss the charge with prejudice after he found? After he accepted the appellant's pleas as provident?
He just acknowledged trial counsel's representations. Whether the judge actually made a ruling that the charges were dismissed with prejudice is unclear from the record on how that should be interpreted. The government's position is that the military judge was just acknowledging that the charges were withdrawn.
Acknowledging it by granting it? Your request is granted. What does that mean? I acknowledge that by granting it.
Whether the government makes a motion to withdraw or whether the, because the convening authority doesn't need to make a motion to withdraw charges, they just withdraw the charges. And that's something that doesn't require a military judge's approval. And the government is just, at the end of the day, is just asking for clarification. Because if these words in PTAs where the convening authority agrees to withdraw with prejudice, if that forever binds the United States and protects that accused forever against those charges, regardless of what may later happen, then if that's the state of the law...
Well, the government makes it sound like it had no choice here, but it wasn't required to put these words in the PTA, was it?
No. And that's, it's as Judge Michael observed in his dissenting opinion, that's a what he described it as was trial practitioners playing fast and loose with the rules. Certainly this is something that the government can address through administrative channels, but if this court were to make clear that with prejudice language forever binds the United States, regardless of if a pleas are later withdrawn, that'll provide guidance to the fleet and promote the fair and efficient...
Does the constitutional protection against double jeopardy apply in courts martial, or is protection limited to Article 44?
Oh, absolutely, the constitutional protection for double jeopardy.
Okay, so Article 44 and the Constitution both apply.
Yes.
Thank you.
Article 44 provides certainly at least as much protection, if not more, than the constitutional prohibition against double jeopardy.
Counsel, return to where the question I had before about the second trial and the agreement that the convening authority made. Under the theory in the government's brief, on page 10 and page 11, is it not the situation that the pretrial agreement that was negotiated between the appellant and the convening authority is impermissible in the government's view because the convening authority agreed to dismiss charges with prejudice? An authority which the government now says that he didn't have, even acting under Article 60.
The point the government is trying to make is that the law is unclear. This is a very common trial practice, and
I understand the point you're making now. So now you're not taking the position that you took on page 10 that it is a legal nullity. You would like us to address whether it's a legal nullity.
The government's position is that it's a legal nullity because convenience...
So the government screwed this up twice. The government screwed it up in PTA 1 by promising something it couldn't deliver.
Yes.
Now you're saying the government screwed it up in PTA 2 by promising something it couldn't deliver.
Yes. And
okay.
Well, what do we do about the situation that the appellant's left in where he can be tried for rape tomorrow, even though the convening authority said if you plead guilty, that can't happen to you?
The point of the government saying that the with prejudice language is a legal nullity is that it is not the same thing as a military judge dismissing a charge with prejudice.
I understand that, but isn't the appellant now exposed to being tried for rape tomorrow?
Absolutely not, because he still has a pretrial agreement. If the government were to try him for rape tomorrow, they would be breaching the pretrial agreement.
But the pretrial agreement's a nullity.
No.
Yeah, and under the government's theory, the benefit that he would get from the pretrial agreement is that it would be, the government would say, well, we're not going to perform that since the convening authority can't do it. Therefore, it's, everything is null and void, and we can go back to the beginning and try him again for everything. Isn't that the government's position in this case? Because he now didn't get two parts of his promise. He didn't get sent to Miramar, and he's not getting the guarantee of no prosecution for rape. The government's consequence for engaging in that is that the government gets to try him all over again for everything.
I want to just make sure I understand your question, Judge. Are you talking about the government being able to retry him for everything?
Right. In other words, now we've got another problem under the government's theory is that he's once again got a promise that the government can't deliver, can't promise him dismissal without prejudice.
Counsel, my understanding, and I'm sorry, but just to make sure that I'm understanding, I thought that the government's argument with respect to whether or not the convening authority could or could not withdraw or dismiss with prejudice or not without prejudice went to the first issue, which we did not grant, which was whether or not it was error for them to do this or not. and didn't go at all to the second issue, which is assuming that it was error for them to try him on the second charge, whether it was prejudice or not, prejudicial or not.
That is correct, Your Honor. And the, as far as government's position is, government seeking a clarification of the law. Can a convening authority withdraw and dismiss a charge with prejudice, and does that bind the United States forever and ever from re-referring that charge no matter what happens down the line?
But how does that help us answer the question that we granted, which goes to prejudice? That's nice that you would like clarification.
That only went to the issue of if this court does find prejudice, what is the underlying error? And the government's point there was is if there is if this court does find prejudice, then there must be some underlying error under Article 59A that supports that finding of prejudice in the first place. And the government's goal in addressing that issue in the first place was to identify whether a convening authority can bind the entire United States to dismiss a charge with prejudice in the same way that a military judge can do so, or if that language is a term of art where the meaning of all the parties is that so long as the pretrial agreement remains in effect, the government can never re-refer those charges. And it's the government's position that because that with prejudice language is a nullity, I'm seeing my time is up.
You can conclude.
Is that if that phrase is a legal nullity, that just means if the pretrial agreement remains in effect, absolutely, the government cannot re-refer those charges. So long as the accused upholds his part of the bargain, the government is obliged to uphold its, which is to not re-refer those charges, regardless of whether they're labeled with prejudice or without prejudice, simply because convening authorities don't have the authority under the manual to label withdrawal as such. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Counsel for the defense, do you have rebuttal?
No, Your Honor, if there are no further questions.
Yeah, I've got a question. And that is, with respect to the proceeding that took place at the second rehearing, when the defense made the motion to address the question of whether the rape charge could be referred, did the defense at any time say that this motion is based upon an inability to negotiate a pretrial agreement because I'll be having that sword hanging over my head?
No, Your Honor, that was not explicitly stated by trial defense counsel.
And at any time during the plea inquiry or otherwise during the proceeding at the trial court, before it came up to the Court of Criminal Appeals for the third time, did the defense say that there's a problem with this pretrial agreement because we had the rape charge hanging over our head?
No, other than the mere fact that they raised the motion, Your Honor. And then, of course, we have the appellant's declaration now.
Okay, thank you.
Counsel, I have one quick question. Is it the appellant's understanding or belief at this point in time that a charge of rape could be reinstituted against the appellant in light of the pretrial agreement? Do you understand my question?
I do understand your question, Your Honor. Under the government's theory, it certainly seems possible. However, as the appellant sees the law, then no, the government, just as the government should not be able to re-refer it after the first court martial, the government should not be able to try him again at this point.
Well, I mean, just as a matter of military practice, when charges are withdrawn pursuant to a pretrial agreement, barring some other circumstances, I mean, are people retried on charges that are withdrawn? Whether the convening authority can say it's with prejudice or not with prejudice, you understand what my question is?
Yes, sir. I know the appellant's not aware of any such circumstance.
Doesn't Rule 604 specifically contemplate re-referral of withdrawn charges and has no prohibition on re-referral of those charges?
Well, it says if there's an improper reason, it would not be permitted, Your Honor. So that would certainly be a separate hurdle for the government to jump over.
Right. Thank you.
Thank you.
We thank both counsel for your presentation today, and the case is now submitted, and the court will stand in recess until 10:25 this morning.
All rise.